It's a great pleasure and privilege to have a chance to talk to Simon Blackburn. Simon, when and where were you born?
I was born near Bristol, in Chipping Salisbury, in 1944, just near the end of the Second World War.
And depending on how far back you want to go, do you remember anything, or do you think you were influenced by your grandparents, for instance?
Not very much. I do remember both sets of grandparents. My mother's parents were small country people. They lived in a cottage in a village called Ireshopeburn up in the west, up in western Durham in the Pennines. I suppose the nearest big town would be Barnard Castle. But that was, you know, a very restricted kind of life. It was country life, actually, although my mother's father had worked, I think, in the lead mines up in Weardale. The area is famous for its minerals, and lead mining had been an industry there until certainly into the 20th century. But he then worked mostly, I think, with horses, with a groom. And my mother's mother was probably the power there. She was a school teacher, and I think had distinct intellectual ambitions, especially for her daughter, who was her only child. And so my mother came from, you know, good old Pennine stock, a strong nonconformist element. She wasn't religious, but I think the nonconformism, as it were, stayed there. On my father's side, my grandfather was rather grander. He was the managing director of the Sunderland and South Shields Water Company. Civil engineer. He'd clearly been very clever. He'd got lots of, books which are prizes and so on. And he managed the water distribution system for the northeast of England, or large parts of it. And that was before the Northumbria Water Authority came along and swallowed up all the other water authorities in the area. And that was the profession my father went into. And so he more or less followed in his father's footsteps, although he wasn't quite as grand. But he became a distribution engineer for the same company, I suppose.
Tell me something about the character of your parents, insofar as you can imagine they might have, that might have influenced your intellectual or other life.
Right. Well, I think my mother was ambitious. My father was not. He was a very gentle man, very laissez-faire. And he was mildly dyslexic, and this actually runs in the family, although I am not, but our son is, and my sister was. His spelling is, my father's spelling was absolutely appalling. He never learned to spell until the end of his days. For such an intelligent man, that was rather surprising. But I think it gave him, or was one of the things that gave him a very, you know, sort of forgiving attitude to life. He was a lovely man. People really adored him. And so that was the two. They were rather different in many ways. And that's, I guess, you know, I think I probably have streaks of each of them in me, insofar as you can say that about genetics.
You said your mother was ambitious. Ambitious socially or intellectually or...?
I think a mixture of both. I think she saw intellectual achievement as a way of advancing socially. I think she was, in a sense, pleased to get out of rural, you know, the rural backwater. She met my father, and my father came out to work on a project called the Burnham Dam, which was built in the Pennines, just north of where my mother lived. And, you know, I think, you know, catching an engineer from the city was rather a good thing. But I think she always felt that, you know, becoming a lawyer or a doctor or one of the professions would be the key to having a good life in England. And therefore she was very anxious that her children should progress to the point where that was realistic.
And her children were you and a sister?
Me and a sister, and I also had a younger brother.
You had a younger brother, yes.
Yes, he's dead.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything about your sort of preschool years? Any flashes of memory for those days?
Not really, no. I have a very vague memory of a green car. And I believe that my father had a green car until possibly about 1948 or 9, so that may be a memory from before, around the time I was 3 or 4. After I went to school, I can distinctly remember first going to school at the age of 5. So then memory.
What do you remember about it?
I remember being singled out as being able to spell the word beautiful. B-E-A-U-T-I-F-U-L, as we do it. And that was thought to be a rather remarkable achievement for a 5-year-old. So I think that was the foundation of my academic career, being singled out as a successful speller.
This school was in Chipping Sodbury?
No. By then my parents had moved back to the northeast. My father worked with the West Gloucestershire Water Company, actually, just after the war. And but then he got his eventual job as distribution engineer for the Southern and South Shield Water Company. So, and we moved back to the northeast, and the prep school was called Tunstall School. Sunderland, I believe it still exists, although I'm afraid I've had no contact with it for all these years.
This is a prep school, so this is from the age of 8?
No, in fact it was a day school for 5-year-olds as well.
But you went on in it?
I went on in it until I went to Clifton, which was my secondary school.
I mean, that first preparatory school, and even the kindergarten, so to speak, is often quite influential. There's sometimes a teacher or something that happens there that influences you.
Right. Well, I'm sure there was a number of things, some good, some bad. I remember one traumatic event, which has blighted my life ever since, which is at a very early age, possibly 5, 6, not much more, being told that I shouldn't join in the singing of the bells of Abu Dhabi.
What a devastating blow.
Because I had such a terrible singing voice, or I was unable to hold a tune or hold a note, and I still am. I now think, looking back at it, that this was not the way to treat a child who obviously needed help musically, and it's always been a matter of regret to me that I didn't either by nature or nurture, didn't ever become very musical. That's a principal regret almost. So I remember the trauma of not being good enough to sing the bells of Abu Dhabi. That was a bad thing. I remember being bored out of my mind with Latin, and I think that probably contributed to not being a very good linguist in later years. After that, though, on the science side, it was all positive. We had a wonderful mathematics teacher.
You remember his name?
He was Cheshire. He was the brother of Leonard Cheshire.
Oh, yes.
BC, the chap who set up the Cheshire Homes. And this, this chap was a big man. He was very a commanding presence in the classroom. And I thought a very, very gifted teacher, at least he brought me on in mathematics, suited me very well, and later on physics, although physics wasn't much taught at the prep school level. And so that laid, I think, the foundations, really, of a future academic career.
Were there any hobbies you had then? I mean, did you wander around the beautiful Yorkshire or Durham moors?
I used to play a lot with a boy my own age on a farm. He was a farmer's son. So in that sense, yes. But I was never taught to observe very closely, so I didn't, as it were, become a John Clare or a Wordsworth. I didn't learn to lost opportunity in a way. They did enjoy the open airs.
And what about games? Were you beginning to, did you play games?
I was pretty hopeless at games. I didn't like football. Football always seemed to be cold, muddy, wet. Leather ball, which weighed a ton, and you broke your foot when you kicked it. Cricket, I quite enjoyed cricket, and there was a period in my life when I was a reasonable leg-break bowler, but that was at a very low level. So, no, I enjoyed cricket much more than football. When I went away to school and we played rugby, I enjoyed that much more than either of them. Rugby, I could sort of follow myself around. Skill and speed counted as slightly less in favour of just brawn and willingness to muck in. And so rugby was alright. But soccer I never got on with. And cricket I was fairly lukewarm about.
Returning to the music aspect, even though you were told you couldn't sing and claim that you haven't been able to since, more or less. Has it, music been in any other forms important to you?
Well, I enjoy listening to it. I think as much as, well, I'm not sure about whether as much as the next man, because the more prepared your mind is, the more you get out of things. And I think partly as an ally to being unable to sing is a rather deficient memory. Remember when I've heard a piece, but apart from some of the very well-known chestnuts in the repertoire, I can't usually remember what it was. And people have got fantastic memories and can remember which key it was played in when they last heard it and so on. Clearly get much more out of music. On the other hand, I do enjoy it.
Which kind of music?
Almost entirely classical. I don't have very much interest in any other genre.
And within classical, the great classics?
I'm pretty conventional, yes. Yes. Wagner's, I'm afraid, pretty much a closed book to me. I've never put in the legwork of the hours. But otherwise, I'm fairly eclectic.
It's never influenced your work in the sense that some people listen to music and are inspired by it or use it as a background to their work in some way.
No, I wouldn't say it has. I don't think so. I can't think of an influence there. No. On the other hand, painting I'm very fond of, and derive enormous pleasure from looking at it. I don't actually practice it, but I always enjoy that.
And again, painting, which painting?
Well, I mean, I know much more about the European tradition than other parts of the world. So you could say most of the great European classics. And I don't know if I've got a favourite painter. I suppose if I had to save the works of one, it might be Vermeer. I got to admire more and more people over the years. So, for example, I think in my 20s I wouldn't have given most Raphaels much time, but now Raphael's a wonderful painter. And then, of course, there's Titian and Rembrandt and all the usual suspects. But I get a lot out of painting.
Moving on to Clifton, why did you go to Clifton?
Well, I think it was. My parents had, my sister's older than me, and she'd been sent to Clifton High School for Girls when my parents still lived in Bristol. And somehow that gave them an affinity with Clifton. And so it was their choice to put me in for Clifton when I became, I think, 11 actually, into the scholarship examination. I was lucky enough to get one.
Tell me about any particular moments at Clifton that fed into your later life.
Well, I mean, in the standard, I mean, it was a very good school, I think I'd say that straight out. There were no public school horrors lurking behind the wainscot. I think it treated me well. I enjoyed my time there by and large. I was homesick to begin with. But
you were a boarder there, obviously.
And again, some of the teaching was excellent, some not so good. They did nothing very much to rectify my linguistic incapacities.
Mm.
So I think I was always rather lazy with languages, actually. But I mean, I passed all the usual O levels and so forth perfectly well. But the science side was very good, and that's where I eventually, in those days, of course, you had to specialise at A level.
Mm.
And so after I'd been there a year, I took O level, and I'm very young, absurdly young, I think. And after I'd been there a year, I started to specialise in maths, physics, and chemistry. Done maths, physics, and chemistry for A level.
Mm.
And enjoyed that very much, academically.
Were there, again, any teachers who you especially remember?
Yes, there's a man called Davis who was a wonderful teacher of chemistry. Chemistry can be very dull.
Mm.
I think A-level syllabus was appallingly dull.
Mm.
But he was very good. It wasn't just stinks and bombs and things. It was serious science, but very well taught.
Mm.
So I remember him particularly.
Mm.
I don't remember any charismatic physics teaching. And physics, I think I always found that harder probably than it should be. But I think physics is very badly taught even now, and I'm sure it was then. I think far too much physics teaching takes for granted that a child is going to just know what's meant by some really very abstract concept like energy.
Mm.
And a concept that probably has a history behind it.
Mm.
And in that case, two or three centuries of people fighting over it, you know, people like Leibniz and Newton and so on. And, you know, the idea that you can just sit down and toss the letter E at some poor child and then they're going to become a physicist because they can solve the equations strikes me as dotty. And yet I think physics is very largely taught like that, still now.
Mm.
And I was always, you know, minded to ask, well, what's going on here, and I don't understand this, and so on.
Did that irritate them?
I don't remember being ticked off for it, but I think it contributed to a gradual drift on my part away from the hard sciences.
Mm.
I can't remember a traumatic episode of being made to stand in the corner for asking what energy was, or you know, what an electric current was, or something. But I know those questions were always in my mind, and I think, as I say, the fact that they didn't get answered sort of eventually contributed to a drift into the arts.
Mm. Were there any other activities there that you, like drama or politics?
Right. I discovered an aptitude for shooting. It turns out I was really rather a good rifle shot.
Mm.
And we won the cadet pair, friend and I. That's at the public school shooting competitions at Bisley. And we won the snap shooting. I was part of the team that won that. We never won the Ashburton Shield, which is the peak, the pinnacle of public school shooting.
Mm.
But I used to enjoy that a great deal. No, as far as acting and things go, I never really had the ambition. It was never something that appealed to me as a way of as it were, losing myself. So I think that apart from academic work, I spent a lot of time messing about, as far as I remember. I know I was friends with the boy who had a genuine technical gift. He was very, very gifted. He made radios and all the usual things. He made a tape recorder, which was very grand in 1960, some level, probably also, I realised that this guy had a gift that, you know, was beyond me. That he was, you know, the stuff of which engineers are properly made, and designers and physicists. So I think that was also part of the uncertainty about whether the hard sciences were for me.
Mm.
So by the time I took the Cambridge entrance, I was pretty determined to leave the hard sciences.
Mm. One theme of your later work in philosophy is religion, negatively.
Yes.
School at this time is often the time that you are confirmed. Find that you no longer believe in this, or find a new devotion. Well, what was your religious life like up to leaving Clifton?
That's an interesting thing. I did have, I suppose, a vaguely religious year. I can remember a yearning, thinking there must be something. I think this was partly when I very first went to Clifton, and as I think I mentioned, I was moderately homesick. You know, it's unpleasant to go away, and home is a long way away, much longer than for some of the boys, for example, who pop home at weekends. When the sun comes up, Newcastle obviously, you wouldn't pop home for a weekend. So I think I was a bit unhappy to begin with. And of course then you start thinking, well, the consolations of religion have some appeal. And the school had its chapel. I didn't loathe it. By the time I left, I found it incredibly boring, but at the time I thought it was kind of rather interesting. So a friend and I decided we would get confirmed. And a friend was going through more or less the same phase of life. And we started going to confirmation classes run by the school chaplain, who rejoiced in the wonderful name of the Reverend the Honourable Oliver Twistleton Wickham Fines. He's part of the same family as the explorer, I suppose. Mm. I didn't actually much like the Reverend the Honourable Oliver Twistleton Wickham Fines. And I think there's some justice, because I always remember the first day of the confirmation class, and he asked us where we'd been baptised. And I didn't know that I had been baptised.
Mm.
And in fact, it later turned out that I hadn't. My parents had no religious beliefs at all.
Mm.
But Robin, this friend of mine, Robin Vernade, had been baptised. His father was a district commissioner in India. And all Robin could say about where he'd been baptised was that he'd been told that it was in a little church in the foothills of the Himalaya. And so he put this down in answer to this question of where he'd been baptised. And the Reverend, the Honourable, flew into a frightful paddy because he thought he was taking the mickey. He thought that this answer was so off the wall that he must be parodying the whole thing or something. Which was not the case.
Mm.
But after this flagrant injustice, we just chucked it. We decided, well, if that's Christianity for you, I want no part of it. And it didn't take very long for this rather superficial interest or pull to dissipate itself.
Mm.
And then, by the time I was 15 or 16, I was a committed atheist. Well, I will talk about the word later,
yes.
But
yeah.
I never had any religious belief after that.
And you never had any religious experiences?
No, nothing of the kind at all. I don't really believe in... Well, partly I'm a rather strange atheist, because I don't really believe in religious belief, for reasons we'll come to.
Hmm.
But I certainly don't believe really in religious experiences either.
Hmm.
I know that people have experiences which they then interpret in religious terms, but I think the interpretation has not much to do with the experience.
Hmm. Good. Well, we'll look forward to coming back to that shortly.
Yes, I'm sure we shall.
Okay, well, let's take you... you applied to Oxford?
No, I applied. Clifton was very Cambridge orientated, especially for the scientists.
Yep.
And so I was sent to Trinity. And I went in for the scholarship exam, and Trinity, with its excellent good sense, didn't give me a scholarship. But perhaps it's slightly less good sense, they did offer me a place. And so that was okay. And I got the scholarship later, and I started getting firsts, but that was later.
To read?
To read. Well, now that's a very interesting question, because this is a question of how I came to philosophy. In the sixth form at Clifton, we had a basically a sort of fig leaf, you know, a token reading hour or something for scientists, where we're supposed to read an improving work of literature to get away from the bench and the slide rule. And for one term for that, we had a very good master, a man called Scott, who later became, I think, the headmaster, but certainly was a senior master at Winchester. And Martin Scott, he took us through Moore's Principia Ethica.
Gosh.
This wasn't for you know, bread and butter reasons, it wasn't to impress admissions tutors or anything, it was just, he thought it was a book we ought to know about. And I rather liked that, so I had a kind of sense that philosophy was something I might rather like. However, when I came up to Cambridge, I'd intended to change to English. When I came up to the admissions interview. The admissions interview took place in 2010. There was this very fierce old boy with a sort of handlebar moustache. Really a throwback to the 1930s.
Can we name him?
Yes, he was called Vivian.
Vivian.
What was his Christian name? I'm not sure I ever knew his Christian name. Dr. Vivian. And he was a historian. And he was really quite gruff. And, you know, wore a sort of tweed suit that would just be made out of barbed wire or something. And very terrifying. And he said, what's all this about? I'd put on my admissions form at some point that I wanted to change to an art subject. He said, what's all this about changing an art subject? And I said, well, I didn't want to tell him the true reason, which was that I was A, slightly bored with natural sciences, and B, that by then I was discovering that friends who were reading things like history and English were having a much better time, because they had things they could talk about. They got off to cellars and coffee bars and whistle and could pick up girls with their knowledge of Dostoevsky and so on. Could never pick up a girl with her knowledge of the properties of zinc or something. And so I said yes. I felt a pull towards the humanities on an art subject, and thought I might read English. And without a moment's hesitation, Vivian just said, "You can't read English. Sloppy subject. You won't like it. Moral sciences is the thing for you." And I just said, what's that? And he said, we'll send you a reading list, which they did. And I adored it. It was exactly the right thing for me. And all the questions which I never got answered, like what is energy, and you know, what are imaginary numbers, and so on, you know, I learned to ask seriously by philosophers and got answers in some cases. So, you know, it was the best bits of science, as it were, without a lot of the drudgery. But also it opened my eyes to a whole literature that I'd not really known about before. So that worked beautifully. So whether Vivian was just lucky or whether he got an insight, I don't know. But anyhow, I often thanked my lucky stars that I haven't got gone to the admissions tutor next door and had a completely different set of prejudices and might have set me off to law or something.
Well, tell me about your time at Cambridge. Were there any... There must have been teachers who particularly impressed you or interested you.
Oh, yes. Well, the great influence on all of us in Trinity College was Casimir Louis. In those days, Casimir was a Polish Jew. He'd left Germany just in time, just before the Second World War. He'd been studying in England. He was an absolute charismatic teacher. He was a gifted teacher. An enormous influence on a whole generation of philosophy students in Trinity. Ian Hacking, Edward Craig, myself, Crispin Wright. Many of us became, academics. He just had this great gift of knowing how to, as it were, dangle standards just always just slightly in front of your nose. So you go away feeling, I've done well, but I could do better. And I've always thought that was a great gift of a teacher, that he wasn't discouraging, or not overtly discouraging. But on the other hand, he never left you complacent either. And he got a lot of work out of us, I think. But it was a pleasure. So he was the big teaching influence. The moral sciences faculty, as it was then called, it wasn't until Bernard Williams came here that he insisted it was changed to philosophy.
Mm.
Those days it was moral sciences. And it was a little bit of a madhouse. I mean, there was rather a lot of a madhouse when I think back at it. Even Casimir had his strange side, but the rest of them were pretty were pretty weird. Some of them.
Can we have a pen portrait or two of their?
Well, there's a very good, numerous stories, but John Wisdom and Richard Braithwaite were the two chairs.
Mm.
Braithwaite was the library's chair. Wisdom was then just the professor of philosophy. C.B. Broad was still a presence. He still existed as a life fellow of Trinity. And I got to meet him quite a lot because I was on his staircase. But Wisdom, for example, was extraordinary. He was a little man, rather wizened, very sepulchral voice, and completely unconventional teaching style. I think in a way looking back at it, I think he was probably disillusioned with philosophy. So he didn't have any ambition to teach, as it were, anything remotely resembling a syllabus. But he'd come in and sort of ask bizarre questions, and there was a certain amount of theatre about it. A story I didn't see this, but a friend of mine, Edward Craig, who was couple of years older than me doing philosophy at that time, swears he was in a class when Wisdom came in, and he was used to slump on the dais because that was a habit that Wittgenstein had, a sort of Wittgenstein slump it was known as, and sort of groan about it all being far too difficult. And on this occasion he sort of slumped and the class was looking, and then suddenly he got up and with a very weary look, he said, I did this. And of course everyone thought, oh God, he's finally flipped. Poor boy's going mad. And then he stalked around the class still doing this. And eventually said, suppose I'm a poacher with a silent dog whistle. How do I tell the difference between a malfunctioning whistle and a disobedient dog, which is actually, which which is actually quite a good question if you're thinking about something like the verification principle.
Mm.
But of course, it's at least it's a lecture that was remembered. It can't be said for many of our lectures. So perhaps there was method in his madness, but he was eccentric, and Richard Braithwaite was pretty eccentric by then.
In what way? I mean, he had a tough wife as well.
He had a very tough wife. I remember one meeting at the Moral Sciences Club, and Braithwaite's wife was sitting in the front row. Jonathan Bennett, one of the lecturers, was more or less directly behind her. And the speaker was a very saintly man, William Neal from Oxford, who was over talking about something. He was talking about the logical problem, as it's called, of negative existential. How can you actually say that something doesn't exist because the word you used to refer to it would seem to have no meaning if there's nothing there for it to refer to. So how does that work? And Neil was talking about this, and he happened to choose as his example witches don't exist. And every time he said witches don't exist, Jonathan Bennett just went like this.
Margaret
Masterman, Braithwaite's wife in front. So that was another less than dignified episode. She was a piece of work, I think.
Mm, she used to wear green gumboots or something.
That's right, exactly, yes. I never had very much to do with her, thank God, but she, I think she lured people into some slightly dotty Christian sect, allegedly in a caravan. I never had anything to do with it.
Later on, towards the end, got old, that couple, weren't they looked after by Elizabeth Anscombe or someone like that? A philosopher came and... did you know about...
I didn't know, no. I think by the time... Braithwaite was still pretty hale and hearty by the time I left. And I suppose he must have retired about 66 when Bernard came, 1966, 67. I left Cambridge in October 69, I think I started my job in Oxford.
Yes, it may not have been Elizabeth Anscombe, but there was someone who came.
It could have been Elizabeth.
There was someone who came to Cambridge after teaching at Manchester, and she wrote most of her philosophical works at the end of her life in her 80s and 90s after the Braithwaites had died, but she'd been looking after them for some years.
I think that probably wasn't Elizabeth. Would that have been Alice Ambrose? Or it wasn't either. I know who you mean, Dorothy Emmett.
Dorothy Emmett.
It was Dorothy Emmett who looked after Braithwaite.
That's right.
That's right, yes. I never knew Dorothy Emmett. I met her once. But in a professional context, I didn't see her. I didn't know her.
Was Bernard Williams here?
Bernard arrived about 67 as well, I think, 66, 67.
That was just after you left.
No, I was still here. Mm. I overlapped with Bernard for perhaps 2.5 years. Mm. I came up to Cambridge in 62, graduated in 65. I was then a research student for a couple of years. 67, I got a research fellowship at Churchill College. Mm. And I was there for a year and a half, and then I went to my permanent job at Oxford.
Mm.
So I overlapped with Bernard by about 2.5 years, perhaps.
Mm. You knew him through his life as well, so what was he like?
Yes. Oh, Bernard was remarkable, of course. He was a breath of fresh air to Cambridge. He was a breath of fresh air wherever he went, I think, but a gust of fresh air.
Mm.
He was very smart, as everyone knows. He was very quick. He was a peculiar combination. I think there was quite a deep pessimism in Germany. He had no very exalted ambitions for either philosophy or for the human race. Although he was probably best known as a moral philosopher, he had very, very few illusions about what could be achieved with moral philosophy. I think he thought that political philosophy was important, and I think he thought that reflection was important. So he wasn't, as it were, cynical or despairing about being a philosopher. But I think he was, at some level, quite pessimistic about it. Mm-hmm. And he was certainly very pessimistic. He had the most cutting tongue. He'd tell these scurrilous stories about people, always incredibly funny.
Mm-hmm.
But in spite of the pessimism, I think he was always very, absolutely exhilarating to be with.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a wonderful magnet for stories, gossip, fun. You always knew if there was a party on where Bernard was, because it was where people were laughing the loudest and apparently having the best time. And that was a wonderful gift. He was by no means hail fellow well met, but he's had the same exhilarating effect on people. So I was very fond of Bernard. I also think he had a very kindly streak, which wasn't always apparent. I mean, he was certainly very malicious about colleagues and people that he could stick a pin into. But I remember when I'd been in Oxford about a couple of years, I was still a very young academic. I was invited back to the Moral Sciences Club here and gave a paper on Elizabeth Anscombe about long being at Cambridge at that time. She arrived, I think, in 69 or 70. I know I crossed with her. I went to Oxford, she came to Cambridge. And she was being absolutely appalling, which she could be. She arrived at this meeting late. She arrived with an entourage. Tremendous kerfuffle and noise and interruptions. They all got seated. One of her daughters, they got seated quite near me as speaker. One of her daughters, rather ostentatiously, sort of stroked her mother's hair all the time. Talk was going on, and there'd be little muttered whispers and so on. So there's this awful kind of one-upmanship going on. And anyhow, the evening struggled to a close, and I was rather despondent about this. So I'd done nothing in my career up to then to offend Elizabeth Anscombe, but I didn't know that I had. I rapidly took care of that, but at the time I hadn't offended her. And so it was a very unpleasant evening, at least it was from my point of view. But Bernard, he immediately just scooped me up. He took me back to the Provost Lodge here and, opened a great big bottle of whiskey and spent about an hour detailing Miss Anscombe's various infirmities and faults and flaws, which of course made everything seem much more cheerful. And I think it was just an act of kindness. It was also a stage for him to tell his stories about Miss Anscombe. But it was very nice of him, and I appreciate that. I always got on with him. I like the twinkle in his eye.
You say you went on to start a PhD, presumably. Who was your supervisor?
Well, it was mostly Casimir Louis, actually, still. There wasn't the same... I think it was slightly unhealthy, actually. Casimir was very protective of his Trinity people. He liked to keep them. So I think I'm right that of three people in the 2 years surrounding me, four people who went on to read PhDs in Cambridge, I think Edward Craig, Jimmy Altham, Anthony Lamb, but myself, I think Casimir kept all of us as a supervisor into our graduate years. so I kept him. I saw quite a lot because of the topic of my thesis of Richard Braithwaite in those years.
The topic was what?
The topic was the so-called problem of induction, or Hume's problem.
Hmm.
Simply the problem of why we feel entitled to extrapolate uniformities of nature beyond the regions of space and time in which they've been observed to hold, and imagine to cover regions of space and time beyond our ken, either in the future or in the distant past or whatever. So it's really a problem about the reliability of natural laws and the various approaches to it. One of them is probabilistic, and Braithwaite was the man for probability theory in Cambridge at the time. So I saw him a few times.
Was he helpful and good?
Yes, very. In a way, it wasn't one of his central interests, but wherever there was any technical problem with probability, he was very helpful. But I admired Casimir's mind, and he sort of always got useful, interesting things to say, even if, like this topic, it wasn't his own special baby. He wasn't really a philosopher of probability or science. He had no interest in the history of the problem of induction. Casimir was really interested in logic and the philosophy of language. And this was not a problem in logic or the philosophy of language. But still, he was always helpful, had things to say. But I think it was part of the climate at the time was that Cambridge was very introverted. So, and the only one of us who broke out and went to, in this case, Oxford for a PhD was Crispin Wright, who had a very distinguished career. I think that was the right thing to do. In America, of course, if you do an undergraduate major at a university, it's more or less compulsory to go somewhere else to graduate school. And if you come out through graduate school, it's then very unlikely that you get a job in the institution that gives you your PhD. So there's a kind of forced mixing, which I think would have benefited Cambridge. Cambridge was very introverted in those days.
Less so now?
Hopefully. I think less so now. Partly Cambridge in the 60s was still, I think to some extent, coasting on the reputation of Wittgenstein and the grand old years of Wittgenstein, Moore and Russell. So there's a certain complacency, I think, which was just a bad thing. It always is a bad thing. I think with hindsight, I certainly should have been packed off to somewhere where the very serious philosophers of science were, like Chicago, Minnesota, or Pittsburgh, to find some people who tell me to pull my socks up and read Carnap and Kyberg and some of the great people that Cambridge had barely heard of.
Did you ever pack up and go to America? I mean, have you seen
time? Not until I'd been in Oxford for some years.
You mentioned the problem of induction and the Humean approach. I mean, David Hume has had a large influence on your life, I imagine. Tell me about why, what Hume means to you.
Well, oh dear, this could take the rest of the interview. Yes, I came to Hume through working on the problem of induction. I mean, he gave the classic exposition of it. And I think it's true that I graduated here in philosophy, and this is slightly shameful, but it shows something about Cambridge. I graduated, I think, without ever having read a book that was written before the end of the 19th century. Yes, it was slightly shocking. I mean, logic was the be-all and end-all. Sometimes called analytical philosophy, the revolution, inspired by the German logician Frege, and then sort of carried forward by Russell and Moore in Cambridge. And that was the school, that was the tradition, that's what you did. problem induction was already a bit of a strange choice for a PhD. People chose things like logical necessity or the nature of quantification or something, which are problems in the philosophy of language. And when I did, you know, I went back and read Hume as for the classic exposition, and rather fell in love with Hume. I thought it's a wonderful, wonderful writer. It's partly I've always had, I think, a sensitivity to writing in philosophy, as well as what's said, it's the way it's said, which can be so attractive or unattractive. And Hume is very firmly on the attractive side of it. So I, over the years, I made a deeper and deeper acquaintance with Hume. I've never seen cause to reverse my initial admiration. It's just grown. Hume was very looked down on in those days, not only in Cambridge, but even more so in Oxford, because he was thought to have had a naive philosophy of language. Philosophy of language, as I say, was the on end all. But he's come galloping back in, partly because logic and philosophy of language have lost some of their prestige over the last 40 years. Partly because Hume is very properly seen as the first great naturalist in British philosophy. He is absolutely resolute about seeing the human being as just another animal, actually an animal in an ecological niche. As seeing the intellectual and cognitive processes as natural events which are ideally explicable and follow certain kind of patterns and rules. And of course that's very much the dominant tone of your studies in psychology, cognitive science, neurophysiology these days. And he gives marvellous quasi-anthropological reconstructions in game theory and of things like the emergence of cooperation, the first decent account of the emergence of convention, definitely things like language and money in Western philosophy. And that too is seen as absolutely pioneering now. So humans, he's just begun to get a far, far better hearing than he had done 40 years ago, 50 years ago. I mean, Wittgenstein, I think, sort of never read Hume or more or less dismissed him. Lizard Anscombe completely dismissed him. And I think that would be impossible now, just at present. His pendulum is swinging, but at present that would be impossible. And later on in my career, I started working on moral philosophy, and in fact that was an interest before I left Cambridge, because I remember discussing it with Braithwaite, so it must have been there, although it had nothing to do with my doctoral work. But the nature of moral philosophy, I've never been interested in whether people can have abortions or not, leave that for the pulpit and the sermons, but the nature of moral philosophy, what ethics is, what are its claims to knowledge, objectivity, truth, all those kind of meta questions, questions about ethics, have since become something I've written about extensively. In some way. In fact, in the second half of my career, more than anything else.
Do you think that the fact that Hume was highly sceptical and no one could quite make out whether he believed in God or not, though they pressed him to the end. Do you think that chimed with you as well?
Yes, very much so. I mean, Hume is cunning. He's a very, very clever man and a very economical thinker. He never tries to prove more than he needs. And I think on the question of religion, you know, it's famous that he never described himself as an atheist. And in some letters and writings, he appears to disown the term. And this puzzles people because the dialogues, especially dialogues concerning natural religion, which he only allowed to be published after his death, are the greatest sceptical tract in the So it does puzzle people, but I think it's explicable, actually. I mean, at the end of the dialogues, well, perhaps I should backtrack just one moment. Dialogues has three main protagonists. There's a chap called Denia, who's a representative of kind of a fairly mystical wing of theology, the god of the philosophers, the god that's infinite, perfect, eternal, beyond space and time, possibly uncategorizable. There's a chap called Cleanthes, who wants a much more anthropomorphic conception of deity. He's one who bustles about and designs things and makes things happen and has intentions and plans and moral emotions, anger, jealousy, and so on. So that's much more the god of popular religion, the chap with a beard in the sky, if you like. And then there's Philo, who's completely skeptic about religion, because he's undoubtedly human himself. And what Philo does for a lot of the dialogues is set Demir and Cleanthes at each other's throats. Because basically you can't have both. You can't have the god of the philosophers, who's infinite and beyond time and perfect and so on, and somebody who's, you know, messing around directing his son to do this, that and the other, and who's blowing walls down for Joshua and so forth. So at various points in the dialogues, Cleanthes says to Demir, well, you're a mystical god, I mean, that makes, I can't distinguish that from atheism. Mm. And Demir says to Cleanthes, well, you're an anthropomorphic god, I mean, I can't distinguish that from atheism, it's just a sort of a very feeble human projection, as it were. So these two are at each other's throats, and Philo just has to sit back and watch them. And then, finally, when it comes to Philo's own views in section 12, you can see very clearly why he's refusing to call it, why he doesn't have to call himself an atheist. Because either calling yourself a theist or an atheist suggests that you think there is a question. It's a question like, just on all fours with the question, is there a rabbit in this room? And some say yes and some say no. But by the time he's got to the end of the dialogues, Hume's lost, Philo has contrived at least to have lost the question. There is no question, because they've got an it about which nothing can be said. And then it doesn't matter in the least whether you say it exists or it does not exist. And in fact, saying either is collaborating with people who think they know they've got something they're talking about. And Hume has destroyed that, he's undercut any grounds for thinking that. Because the it turns out to have absolutely no consequences. There's nothing, there's no inference or implication you can draw from the supposition that it exists that you couldn't draw without it. Nothing for morals, for politics, for how you conduct yourself, or for what to expect, or how to explain things. So it's left inert. And that's, I think, where Hume stands. So really, basically, he's got to a point where he can cheerfully confess a complete absence of religious belief or religious interest without calling himself an atheist, because calling himself an atheist, as I say, collaborates with the view that there's a discussable question. And that's what he's cut off at the knees. So it's an extremely clever book. In so many ways, very funny as well. But it's, you know, I think professional philosophers like myself tear our hair out when we hear or see the way these things are debated in the press, you know, the new atheists like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and then new defenders of the faith like bunches of theologians. But then, Christ Almighty, this is going back to the 4 centuries ago. should have stopped in 1779, which is when the dialogues were published. But of course it didn't.
A lot of people about Dawkins, and most of the scientists and most people say, you know, it's terribly oversimplified and he's as bad as the people, the attacks and so on. It sounds as if you would just say that he just missed the point, really.
Well, I think so. I shouldn't speak at length about Dawkins because I haven't read his book. I read a lot of his other books. I'm afraid that they give me the impression he's just not a very good philosopher. While he's irritating people, he's not a very good philosopher, but despises philosophy because it's not science. And then pontificates. And a good example, well, one example, is the whole metaphor of the selfish gene. And then he gets into a terrible stew, pretending that we can rebel against our genes and do all this sort of thing, which is just nonsense. Actually, it's the kind of thing religious people believe. Because they think of the soul as a kind of independent locus of agency apart from the mind-brain system. You know, it just makes you tear your hair out. If a first-year student wrote that in a philosophy of mind paper, they'd be thrown out of the university. So, you know, he's a sort of embarrassment. As far as I understand the religious issue, the thing that seems to me so awful, and again Hume is streets ahead of course, is that he seems to think it is purely a question of doctrine and belief. So he thinks there is a question like, is there a rabbit in this room, to which clever people like him answer no, and stupid people answer yes. And of course this is complete nonsense. I mean, Schopenhauer put it beautifully, saying that the allegorical and mysterious natures of religions was in fact essential to them, that we're not in the domain of belief, we're in the domain of practice, and the practice includes contradictory elements, it includes possibly saying things whose meaning is either not there or is, you know, at best evanescent, rather like chanting fairy nursery rhymes or fairy stories. And then you look elsewhere to the point and purpose of the practice and whether it's got an adaptive function. Many social psychologists think that religions have an adaptive function, for example, in terms of enabling groups to coordinate better, to as it were, separate insiders from outsiders, which may not be a very noble ambition, but people have it. And there's some evidence that groups which are cemented together by shared religious practices last much longer. The social cohesion is much stronger than groups which have no religious practices, which presumably has something to do with the staying power of religion. And also its prevalence in countries like the USA, where other more traditional forms of social bonding, that for example you've had in Europe, England say, never had time to form. So we've got relatively heterogeneous groups of people occupying a new country. Perhaps they need some kind of shared practices to keep the whole show on the road. And all that side of it, as far as I understand, completely escapes Dawkins, which means he's not really qualified to think about the issue at all. Just shocking. It's got nothing to do with doctrine and belief. It's got everything to do with human practices, emotions, needs, and adaptations that we form to enable us to get along with each other.
Well, on that side, do you have some sympathy then with religion that you can see?
Yes, indeed, yes. I mean, I think if one separated the issue of these practices, as I call them, from the issue of cognition, of belief, of knowledge, of nature of a supernatural reality, and if you simply sideline that, then the practices stand or fall as other human practices do. Are they beneficial? Are they adaptive? Or are they maladaptations, which we do well to try and shake off? And I think sometimes the answer is yes, and sometimes the answer is no. As I like to put it, you know, even Christians are human. in other words, religions, being human constructs, they sometimes express most terrible things, Spanish Inquisition, or different groups treated each other in Northern Ireland or in the Middle East, or the Muslims treat women, I think.
Mm.
So, you know, there's going to be an upside and a downside.
Mm.
I don't think you can draw up a balance sheet anymore than you can draw up a balance sheet for humanity, for the same reason.
Well, you're a fellow Trinity, presumably, now.
Yes.
Do you go to the chapel?
Oh, never.
Never?
No, I have no religious inclinations.
But would you refuse to go to the chapel? I mean, for instance, for the inauguration of fellows or...
the master.
Or the master.
Oh, no. I'm not superstitious.
And if you were a master of college, you'd be happy to preside over?
That's a little harder, because nobody would take my going to chapel as anything more than a fairly empty ritual. Whereas if I was the master of a college and presiding over the thing, they might take that as more indicative of an endorsement, which I wouldn't necessarily.
I've interviewed Martin Rees on this, Provost of Kings and other.
Yes.
Many of them say, well, we like the service, we don't believe any of it, of course.
Right, that's right, yes. Well, I mean, the aesthetics is fine, you know. I'm afraid I had to start off by confessing to not being terribly musical, but you know, if I can listen to some Bach suites on the organ, I'd be very happy.
Mm. Let's come back to your life. You went to Oxford.
Yes.
And in what position? You were a lecturer?
I was a fellow tutor in philosophy at Pembroke College from 69 until 90.
69 to 90?
Yes.
Gosh, a long time.
Yes.
And how did Oxford compare to
Cambridge?
Cambridge.
I think rather badly in one respect. I think the faculty here, for all its oddities, was at least geographically coherent. Oxford, it's very strange, Oxford has many, many more philosophers than Cambridge. Many colleges have two, just about all colleges have one. I think at any time there's between 50 and 70 people in post in philosophy in Oxford, whereas there's only a dozen in Cambridge. There's a completely different scale of operation. And that's partly because Oxford has all the joint courses. It's got PPE grades, maths and philosophy, physics and philosophy, so on. Whereas Cambridge, you only read philosophy if you read at all. So there's the size of the place is very different. But then the emphasis on college teaching meant a lot of the fellows in philosophy were stuck in their college. Virtually never saw anybody from any other college. And so it was much more college orientated than Cambridge. And indeed, because the conditions of a fellowship were fairly heavy on teaching, you know, so you just found it during term to put your head down inside your own college. Now, fortunately, I had a group of friends that, you know, we met and mingled. And as years went by, I met some of the Oxford greats of the previous generation. But it was, I think, in a way, a slightly, well, I think isolated, and I put it wrong, because by that time I was married and starting a young family, and life was busy in all kinds of dimensions. But as far as professional life went, I think it was slightly isolating, Oxford. I mean, college life, of course, in Oxford and Cambridge can be a terrible snare. You know, you get brilliant people who then go off and become, I don't know, steward of the wine committee or something, and they're never seen again, this sort of thing. Or senior tutor or something respectable can still play hell with your research life. So I think that when I first went to Oxford, it took some getting used to. I also didn't much like the style. I think Oxford is a smarmy place. There were a lot of very complacent people. People were very pleased with their, you know, position at the top of the Oxford tree. You've got the sense of all these old wives who sat around looking at whose kid was top of the class in the dragon school and this sort of thing. Very introverted, nonish society.
I'm glad you mentioned the dragon. That was where I went to school.
That was really?
I met a lot of these children.
Oh, I'm sure you came first.
No, I came well below them. Right. But, yes, that's interesting.
Yes.
Did you teach, did teach, but which parts of your teaching did you particularly like or dislike?
I pretty much enjoy almost any conversation on philosophy. Mm. Obviously one enjoys talking to responsive, bright, alert, interested students rather than the laggards or the dullards.
But you like supervising?
Yes. Mm. I mean, not enough to do it for free, but probably enough to do a little after I've retired.
Mm. And lecturing, you enjoy?
Yes, I've always, I mentioned I've got no acting ambitions or skills, but I've never been afraid of standing on my hind feet and talking, so it came easily. Possibly too easily, as I sometimes stand up, find myself with no notes and nothing in my head. that seems to be right.
Maybe you felt that it's there's been an interchange between your teaching and your writing.
Oh yes. Oh yes, I can't imagine. I'm sure that if I'd suffered the catastrophe of getting a fellowship to All Souls or something, which doesn't require any teaching of you, I'd simply have gone to pot or gone to sleep.
Mm.
I think teaching is, conversation in general, the moral sciences club, small discussions groups, just informal contact with friends, is an essential catalyst to philosophical thought. I very seldom feel that I'm a self-starter. It's because there's this problem which has come across my plate from some exogenous source that I start to think at all and trying to say, well, we ought to be able to do better than that. That can't be the last word on this subject. I don't, on the other hand, of course, teaching can get in the way, because if you've got an idea and you're trying to work it out, then, of course, having, as I did in Oxford, frequently had 15 to 20 hours a week teaching, is going to get in the way.
Have you supervised a lot of PhD or DPhil students?
Yes, far too many.
How many did you get?
Well, over the years. By the time I left Oxford, I think I had 5 BPhil students. Can't remember how many PhD students I had this one. Now it's Cambridge, I think the years since I've been back here, I've had 4 years I've been here. And in Chapel Hill, where I went in the 90s, well, I was on the committees of
Do you enjoy that?
Yes, I enjoy it perhaps less than undergraduate teaching because I'm very conscious that it's much more of an investment of time. Graduate students, the clock is ticking, they're in their 20s, they've made a career choice, nearly all of them. They really do a PhD in philosophy pretty uniformly if you intend to get a job in academia. And I get quite alarmed or upset, involved. You get to know them better, of course. And I get rather involved if, for example, their work isn't going well enough, they're very difficult to write them references that will get them jobs. You quite perjure yourself or you lose your credit. And then that can be rather difficult because you're maybe seeing somebody for a couple of years. You've got to be on the one hand encouraging, on the other hand you mustn't raise false hopes. so far too often, it's a bit of a tightrope.
Mm.
Of course, it's a great place when you've got something absolutely brilliant and quite clear they're going to make a wonderful career, and you know, they do their own work for you practically.
Mm.
Not like in the sciences.
Mm.
That never happens, but you know, they sparkle and help you.
Mm. We're having to skim over things, so let's skim back to Cambridge again. You came back in 1990.
Yes, 1991. In 2001.
2001?
Yes. Oh. In 1990 I left Oxford for the United States.
Ah, right. Tell me about that period.
Well, in the 80s I'd got terribly busy. In 1984 I published a book called Spreading the Word, which was a book of groundings in the philosophy of language. And that was, I think, well received. I should, I'm not the person to say that. I became the editor of Mind, which is the premier British philosophy journal. And as a result, I was getting a lot of graduate students wanted to come and work with me. Mind itself received about 350 papers a year. So there's a huge refereeing job. I felt I had to do most of that myself.
Yes, you describe it in one of your RAE assessments.
Yes, oh yes, you read that.
Yeah.
Yes, well it was a kind of tyranny. But it was obviously it's a lot of work.
Mm.
And I was younger than I am now, and I had the stamina for it. But it began to take its toll. And by the late 80s, I felt, you know, a combination of things. I was rather cross that Oxford showed up very, very little, in fact, no recognition of what being extra mind involved. So there's no teaching relief or anything like that, examining relief. I think I felt underappreciated in Oxford. The Thatcher years were full swing, and you know, humanities in British universities seemed under threat. And I began to get offers from the United States, and they just found me in a receptive mood. So one year my wife and I went over, and we went to the University of Michigan, which is a famous philosophy school, and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We chose Chapel Hill, part of the climate, much nicer climate than Michigan. And then I spent 10 years there, I was very happy there.
Mm.
And it was an enormous relief. The first year I went there, I said I didn't know when it's term time here compared to Oxford.
Mm.
It was just a completely different workload.
Mm.
And a very nice atmosphere, actually.
Because
that was a faculty, all happened in one building, you saw colleagues. And wasn't the same sense of isolation and things happening somewhere else that there was in Oxford. So I was very happy there. And would probably have stayed there except because our children went to university there. But my wife was pulled back here a little bit by her mother's decline. She felt obliged to look after her. Parents had died earlier, they passed away quite, what's the word, politely. And so when Cambridge made me the offer, I came back here.
What does your wife do? Is she
well, she worked as an editor for Oxford University Press for many years. She started off in Cambridge as a copy editor. Redoubtable Judith Butcher, who was the doyen of copy editors. And then when she went to Oxford, she worked for a little while as a school teacher. She got an educational qualification. She'd read English here, she read English under the Ulysses book. And So she then drifted into being back into publishing, because she could do that part-time while her children were still young. But then the immediate superior in Oxford, called Albert Hodgkin, left, and she became the philosophy and law editor. So for about 15 years we were in Oxford, she was the editor. And I say to myself, very good at it. I've better said that than I am a philosopher. and she kept that up a little bit after we went to Chapel Hill, because AUP USA did an operation down in North Carolina. So she could work there. But working away from head office didn't really work out. So then she set up her own business as a little basically book design, typesetting, copy editing, editing. And that worked very well until we eventually came out to Cambridge. And then, well, it was a partnership with a friend. It was going to be too difficult really to keep it going. And she also discovered that on the design and typesetting side of things, you make no money, because the rates are so low in the Far East that publishers won't pay anything for it. So she went back to just freelance copy editing. And now she's moving towards retirement.
That's last bit of the interview. Let's come to your ideas beyond the PhD and so on.
Yes.
One theme seems to be, well, it's not a theme, but an approach you have, which is to try and make philosophy publicly accessible through writing books on topics like lust and truth and things like this, which might reach a wider audience. What is sometimes nice is if you chose a couple of your books which you'd like to be remembered for and tell us what they're really about.
Right. Well, I think the best academic book I've written in the last 15 years isn't one of those popular books. And that's a book called Ruling Passions. And it's basically an exploration of human motivation, and particularly moral motivation, in the light of game theory, in the light of the old perennial questions about objectivity, truth, knowledge in normative areas. I became well known for a kind of tricksy position called quasi-realism.
Yes.
And
what is quasi-realism?
Yes. Well, suppose you start with the thought that really in ethics all we're doing is ordering each other about or laying down rules. It might then seem as though you could have a complete ethic which was just a system of, say, imperative, do this, don't do that, like in the Ten Commandments. So then it becomes a bit of a mystery why we actually express ourselves in ways which make it look as though ethics is much more a question of fact. You know, it's wrong to torture people. Fact, people will say that's a fact, they'll say it's true, and we know that it's true. And one possible response is to say, well, you know, we just deceive ourselves, this is an error. And that was quite a popular position back in the 1970s, associated with a chap called John Mackey. It's there in Freddie Ayer's Language, Truth and Logic, that's been grumbling on for 40 or 50 years, I think, in the Anglo-American tradition. And I wanted to, as it were, square the circle and say that actually you can have both of these. You can have the fundamental thought that the function of ethics is practical. So to that extent, the imperative or the prescriptive appearance would be the right one. But it's also not an accident that we have the subject-predicate form, the propositional form, which makes it possible for us to talk about truth, fact, and knowledge, objectivity, and all the rest. So the trick was, how can you keep these two horses together? How can you keep them pulling together? And I So I tried to produce some models of language equipment which it could be done. And the basic idea was that we needed the moral predicate, good, bad, that ought to be done, that ought not to be done, basically in order to facilitate discussion and coordination. You see, if I give you a command, let's say shut the window, you can either do it or not, but that's about it. If I say you ought to shut the window, well, then you can do it or not, or say, well, now hang on, why ought I to? Because after all, it's your turn, yeah. And so on. So you've got a topic for discussion.
Mm.
So in a sense, I saw moral propositions not as reflecting a mysterious world of moral fact, that I don't believe in, but I saw them as imaginary focuses, foci, imaginarii, facilitating discussion, coordination, and the general negotiation of moral positions in social life. And this seemed to me a satisfactory way of having the best of both worlds, of having the practical function of ethics absolutely center stage, and yet doing justice to the appearances which made people go sort of weak at the knees and start talking about moral intuitions and moral facts and normative realm and so on. And that's been a position that's attracted a good deal of attention, some favourable, some hostile, that's kept me fairly busy for quite a long time.
Mm.
So that's what Ruling Passions was about. I think that's my favourite book, academic book of recent years. That's arguably my only academic. I've written a lot of papers there. As far as other writing goes, yes, I've always enjoyed introducing people to philosophy. I mean, I think it's wanting to share my own enthusiasm for it, you know, what I found when I left the tyranny of the natural sciences, discovered that all this could be discussed in a far more interesting way. And so I think on that score, I have to say Think, which was the first introductory book I wrote, was my favourite. I still think that was quite a good book. I think if this may sound like boasting, but I think probably it was the best introduction to philosophy since Russell's Problems of Philosophy, which was written in 1912. And it certainly made its way and was widely used and been widely celebrated. Widely translated. So I think I'm proudest of that.
Mm.
I don't know why I chained myself to this bench, but I did allow myself to write the Oxford Dictionary of Philosophy, which was quite a task. I suppose
you had to write the whole dictionary, or did you compile it?
No, I wrote it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yes, I know. That's what people say. Well, it was slightly the same as doing the refereeing for Mind, that when you, in philosophy, when you employ collaborators or referees, it very often gives you just another piece of work to do, because it's such a, in a sense, personal subject.
Mm.
You can't often just rely on anybody to write you an expert article or entry. Which has just the light and shade falling where you want it to fall. And so if you want that to happen, you've got to do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I did have people do extensive checking.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to write about Plato without having the Platonists look at it, mm-hmm. and so on. But I did write it all myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now, what are you working on at the moment?
Well, I'm trying to get going a set of thoughts about the pragmatist tradition of philosophy. Mm-hmm. This actually touched upon at lunch. This is, I think philosophers for generations really have been obsessed by our cognitive powers, our power there's a tendency to think of that in terms of just reception of fact. So the mind is the mirror of nature, as Richard Rorty famously put it, only to dislike the image. But, and then there is the counterculture, and Rorty is a member of that, was a member of that, which says no, the mind is for doing other things than reflecting nature. Nature doesn't need a copy of itself. It needs active engagement. So that's the dispute between representationalists and pragmatists, as the labels have it. And rather as with ethics, I'd like to try and find common ground. Seems to me there's something right about saying that we manage to represent the world to ourselves. But there's also something right about saying that our minds don't just copy it. They select saliences, they prepare us for action, they are at the behest of the passions. They're there to enable us to meet our needs and desires. So there's something right about the pragmatist tradition too. Now, lots of people have tried to, and it's not as original to try and have the best of both those worlds as it was in the case of ethics, but I'm not sure that anybody's done it as I would like to see it done. It's been one of these things where people raise labels and manufacture opposition rather too quickly, I think. Whereas at the moment I'd like to see more of this synthesis and see how much of the best of both worlds we can have. And so that's what I'd really like to get on with. When Cambridge allows me to.
Yes, you said you're gathering thoughts. How do you work? I mean, all of us have views of philosophers that they wander around vaguely in peripatetic mode and suddenly thoughts dart into their mind.
No, a thought never darts into an unprepared mind. Mm. You have to prepare, which in my case, as I think I've said earlier on, means conversation, sometimes teaching, sometimes reading. I think I do have a slightly, perhaps northern, bloody-minded streak about me. So if I read something that doesn't quite ring true, or somebody says something that doesn't quite ring true, I'm quite good at saying, hang on, this can't be the way to put it, this can't be the right, this isn't the final word on this. And that will then set me off. Then I start thinking, well, what is the final word? How are we going to do better? So I might read somebody like, I mean, a good example would be a very catalytic philosopher like Richard Rorty. He writes slightly outrageous books. I think he was a deeply serious and interesting mind. But he can't have found the right way to put it. So then the challenge is to try to maintain the insights and find better words in which to frame them and phrase them. So that's a large part of what it is. And to get that sort of stimulus, you have to, as I say, prepare yourself. You have to go and read the literature and see what other people have said about this. I don't really believe in a philosopher, strolling the Trinity Gardens and having great thoughts pop into his mind. Certainly wouldn't happen to me. On the other hand, when you're on the chase, when you've really got a chapter which is proven knotty and interesting, then thoughts can pop into your mind.
Even in Trinity Garden?
Even in Trinity Garden, although more likely when I'm shaving, I think.
What about writing? Do you enjoy writing? And
yes.
And how do you write? I mean,
I think the best 2 weeks I ever spent in my life was just before I came out to Cambridge. I taught myself to touch type on an old sit-up and very manual typewriter. And so I've always been a very fast typist. And when the words are coming easily, I can really work very fast. So once it's there, getting it down is just a journal.
Mm. And do you rewrite and rewrite, or does it more or less come out as...
I do rewrite, but it's, I think, slightly more as I've got older. I mean, my writing style was godforsaken, was awful when I started my career. There was this very Cambridge style Jean Moore had said. Mm. Casimir Louis was very fond of that. It's very much, you know, it would not be unrealistic to suppose that not. And this sort of,
or as one or two of my King's colleagues speak.
Yes, well, exactly. And I think it was my wife's influence that said, look, cut the crap, you know, get down to it. And I think I've taken that advice. And,
Hmm. I'm sure we've missed out many important bits of your intellectual and other life, but we're coming towards the end. Is there anything you'd really like me to have asked you about?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think the thing I'd like to stress is I do very often feel so grateful to Vivian for putting me on the life's path he did, because it's been a wonderful career. I mean, I've enjoyed, I won't say I've enjoyed every minute of it, but I've enjoyed an awful lot of it. Mm. It's taken me around the world, it's enabled me to make friends in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, America, so on. And, by and large, I feel very content at having done it. Well, I think that, if I'd gone into the next door, I might have been, I might have been either a lawyer or something else like that, a civil servant.
Mm.
And that wouldn't have been really so much fun, at least from my present perspective. I think that was the luckiest break in my life.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much indeed.
Right.